Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is August 14th, 2019. As always, I appeal to my listeners and friends for support. My website, rushjournal.org, it can be glitchy. It's under attack on a pretty regular basis. So, if it's not up for some reason, try again later. I receive quite a bit of a electronic attack and it's sealed off as much as humanly possible, by my webmaster. But it can be glitchy for that reason. So, if it's down for any reason, it will come back up. You know how much I hate asking for money. For years and years and years and years, I gave everything away for free, and it wasn't even a thought to do that. But ever since 2014, 2015, everything changed. And it's humiliating and embarrassing for me to do. And for those who have responded, I thank you. You're the only reason that I function here. As I've said many times, this is not a part-time job. It would be impossible to do this, you know, in my spare time, so to speak. Any of these topics we deal with are highly specialized, that require a tremendous amount of concentrated research, and the ability to know how to do research is, by the way, not an easy thing. You're not born knowing how to do it. You're not born knowing how to tell a good argument from a bad one. This is something that comes with many years of training and then experience. And I'm going to prove that here now. I'm going to talk about something that I remember following very closely at the time. In 1991, I was a sophomore in college. And I wasn't advanced enough at the time to ignore most of what the American press says about things. I'm going to talk about the emergency committee that attempted very briefly in August of 1991 to rescue Russia from Boris Yeltsin and the liberal reforms that were going to engulf the country. It was almost comically bad, poorly organized. In fact, it was so bad that it really did nothing more than help the forces of global liberalism. It's hard for a non-specialist to understand, but the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1991 was far more conservative than the Democratic Party in the U.S. This wasn't the party of Lenin and Trotsky. The Jews had long since abandoned it. And the Jackson-Vanik Amendment proves that. This was a national Bolshevik movement, which is why they appealed to the Orthodox Church without irony. This was a nationalist Pan-Slavic and Eurasianist movement in the guise of the Communist Party. In Russian politics, this is what being a leftist is. It's a good thing. Being a leftist is being a national socialist or a national Bolshevik, so to speak. Being a rightist often means I'm going to put it this way. Being a liberal or a believer in democracy. Democracy has nothing to do in the Russian, and it's a loan word from the English and Russian. Has nothing to do with political or even a word like freedom. Has more to do with dismantling state-owned enterprises and the complete destruction of the Russian currency and the Russian economy in the 90s than it has any kind of abstract theorizing. You have to know the terms and the mentality. The so-called left in 1991 were either your National Social, your National Bolsheviks, that had abandoned the mentality of Lenin and changed, and were far more conservative than the system that was trying to replace them. Whether it be in the Tiananmen Square protests we talked about on this show, or in the crowds that gathered in front of the White House in Moscow in 1991, these were you know, kind of the hippies, so to speak, of the era. These were sexual revolutionaries and homosexuals, and those gathering to fight the emergency committee were not monarchists or nationalists by any stretch of the imagination. The emergency committee came together and so reached out to everybody. They made reference to Orthodox people, monarchists, nationalists, any non-liberal person. Remember something else. At the time, there were two entities struggling for power. And this is, you know, I was a very green student, and this was made a huge impression on me. The fact that there were two sources of law, the Russian Republic that had declared independence under President Boris Yeltsin, or soon will, and the USSR, which is still chaired by Gorbachev, who had invented a new office called the President rather than the General Secretary. The Congress of People's Deputies also was something that he invented, inventing political institutions as he saw fit. But by the early 90s, it became clear. Remember, in the U.S., being pro-communist, being pro-Soviet was fashionable. This was not this was something that all progressive people did. Being anti-communist in America at the time, being military at the time, anything having to do with the Vietnam War or the Cold War was something extremely negative, and you had to fight your way to justify it. That was fading, and it was fading largely because of the emergency committee and everything that came. It took a while, but people began to realize that the so-called Communist Party was in fact a Eurasianist and nationalist party that had nothing to do with the individualism, the postmodern, the consumerist, feminist nonsense that was being promoted by capitalism. The capitalist West that was going to impose itself on Russia was far more radical. And it's, whether it be its family policy, its sexual policy, you know, basically lifestyle liberalism kind of things, far more so than the Soviets had ever accepted. The early attempts at sexual liberation in the Soviet Union in the 20s long since were abandoned because it almost destroyed the country. The gulags were gone. That the old prison system was gone. That was gone at least by 1980. Gorbachev had been general secretary initially in 1985, and as we all know, created the perestroika, glasnost, referring to economic restructuring on the one hand and kind of political openness, respectively. And I remember very well. You had American talking heads who actually made a couple of decent points at the time, saying that he was unleashing forces that he may not have expected. Nationalist movements in the republics, which there's very little that he could do anything about. But that had a lot more to do with the massive economic crisis that was engulfing the country. The long lines and the scarcity of food and medicine, this was, late 80s, early 90s. Even essential items were rare. A lot of this has to do with hoarding from mafia groups, which were overwhelmingly Jewish. That was the germ, the origin of the oligarchs later on. Stocks of fuel. Now, this was August, say the summer of 1991. The fuel to get Russia through the winter was non-existent. Inflation had reached almost 300% at the time, and salaries, even if they had the money, couldn't pay them. And if they had the money, it simply wasn't worth anything. Some of you remember in 1990, the Baltics, as well as Armenia and Georgia, had demanded their independence and achieved it. Now, in the Armenian case, they remained very close to Russia. But since the Scandinavian countries kind of took over the Baltics, they were kind of lost to the Soviets forever, or to Russians forever. And as we know, Georgia was eventually taken over. But Armenia remained very loyal to Russia, but still independent. I distinctly remember the conservative press being, you know, just despising Gorbachev when he attempted to take Lithuania by force in January of 91, and an almost civil war breaking out in Latvia, and then the explosion of the battles in like Nagorno-Karabakh in, you know, between Azeris and Armenians, and even the South Ossetian issue in Georgia. As I said, Russia had declared basic independence in a year earlier. And so there was no real mechanism to decide whether Soviet laws that would be administered by Gorbachev or Russian laws under Yeltsin would have any precedence. But since this new system was now associated with the complete destruction of Russia, the population generally supported the restoration of the USSR. The USSR that they demanded, however, was not the USSR of Lenin or Stalin or Khrushchev. In March of 91, and this is something that the Emergency Committee made note of, there was a union-wide referendum. Now, it was, you know, the states that had already committed to independence did not partake of it because they considered themselves independent countries. But there was a referendum, and the exact numbers are 75.9% of the voting population in the entire USSR took part in it. 76.43%, which was about 114 million people, spoke out in favor of preserving the new union, not necessarily the Union of Stalin, but a close union based on essentially what amounts to national Bolshevik principles. Now, the Emergency Committee attempted to take over. Here are the eight men who were a part of it. The Vice President, Gennady Yanyev, the Prime Minister, Valentin Pavlov, the head of the KGB, Vladimir Khrushchev, the Defense Minister, Dmitry Yazov, my favorite of the bunch, Boris Pugo, the Interior Minister, who is of a Baltic background, Baklanov, who was an important member of the Central Committee, Tsar Dubtsev, who was the head of the Peasant Union, and Alexander Tsitsiakov, who was the president of the Association of State Enterprises. That was the eight men that took over briefly in 1991. Starting in 7 a.m., August 19th, this committee took over the radio station, Radio Rossi and several Echo Moskvy, which was based primarily in Moscow, were cut off. Several elite divisions, Tamanskaya division, which was an armor unit, came into Moscow. And there was a thought of detaining Yeltsin. He had been in Kazakhstan, and then he was planning on going on vacation near Moscow, but they didn't do this. And not arresting Yeltsin, of course, was a big problem for them. Yeltsin arrives at the White House the 19th of August, really just a few hours later. And Yeltsin very hypocritically says that this is a reactionary, anti-constitutional coup d'etat. And Yeltsin calls on the military not to take part in this. Yaniev declared a state of emergency a few hours later. Then they said that Gorbachev was ill and could no longer be president of the Soviet Union. The Tamanskaya division defected to some extent, and that was one of the tanks that Yeltsin climbed on. It was a very, very famous picture. And of course, this was broadcast on, you know, the state news channel as if they're trying to fail. You know, they were promoting Yeltsin's propaganda on state radio. I'm not willing to say that this was, you know, Yeltsin or a CIA operation, although they certainly knew about it. It's just that these guys were really bad at propaganda. So the next day, 20th of August, they decide to attack the White House. And they planned Operation Thunder, with several units, Special Forces Alpha in Vinpil, Moscow, Oman, a few others. And they were supposed to, and by the way, Alexander Lebed was supposed to be a part of this. And because they were afraid, because crowds had grown pretty large in Moscow at the time, the bloodshed would be excessive, and it was canceled. Now, the next day, there were a few deaths, and this was the guys who were trying to pull kind of a Tiananmen thing with the tanks and got crushed. There's actually stamps with their faces on them now. And I'm not certain what these people thought they were defending. Concepts like democracy this was an American import. It's not what we think it is, but I don't think that they fully understood what the Russian translation really was. And then really, the 22nd of August, this had failed completely. And the emergency committee was placed under arrest by Boris Yeltsin. And they took over. They issued a statement, and I want to read it in full. This was their agenda. I remember this very, very well. It was given by Yaniev, and he was shaking as he was saying this at the podium. The picture you'll see on this broadcast, you'll see a few of them behind microphones there. They're trying to be, every color is gray. You know, it's not a black and white photo. It actually looks that way. He says, "Citizens of the Soviet Union, in a difficult, critical time for the fate of the fatherland and our peoples, we turn to you. Mortal danger looms over our motherland. The reform policy initiated by Gorbachev, conceived as a means of ensuring the country's dynamic development and democratization of public life, has come to a standstill. The initial enthusiasm and hope were replaced by unbelief, apathy, despair. Power at all levels has lost the confidence of the population. Careerism, another term, politicalism, I don't know how to translate that, but politicalism, has supplanted from public life the concern for the fate of the fatherland and the citizen. Vicious mockery of all the institutions of state is imposed. The country has become unmanageable. Taking advantage of these freedoms, the sprouts of democracy, extremist forces that have taken course to liquidate the Soviet Union and to seize power at all costs. Cynical speculation on national feelings is just a screen for satisfying ambitions. Neither the present troubles of their peoples nor their tomorrow bother their political adventures. Creating an atmosphere of moral and political terror and trying to hide behind a sheet of public confidence, they forget that the ties they condemned and broken were established on the basis of much wider support." Those who, in essence, are working to overthrow the constitutional order must answer to the mothers and fathers for the deaths of many hundreds of victims of ethnic conflicts. And their conscience, the crippled fate of more than 500,000 refugees because of them, tens of millions of Soviet people who yesterday lived in a single family and today turned out to be outcasts in their own home, have lost the peace and joy of life, which should be the social system the people must decide, and they are trying to deprive him of this right. Now, let me interrupt here. Of course, he's referring to the Republican battles, especially in the caucuses. There's often a confusion, you know, defending the Soviet Union in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s versus introducing liberalism. These are two very different things. And sometimes they go back and forth there. They don't like the Soviet Union of the 30s and 40s and 50s. This is not what they're defending. Anyway, they continue here. Instead of caring for the safety and well-being of every citizen in the society, the people in whose hands power has ended up and use it for interests alien to the people as a means of principled self-affirmation. Streams of words and statements, promises, emphasize the poverty and wretchedness of practical matters. Inflation of power worse than any other destroys the state. Every citizen feels a growing uncertainty about tomorrow. It's catastrophically affected the economy. The chaotic, spontaneous slide to the market caused an explosion of egoism. Regional, departmental, group, and personal. The war of laws and the promotion of centrifugal tendencies resulted in the destruction of a single national economic mechanism that took decades to develop. The result was a sharp drop in the standard of living for the vast majority of the Soviet people. The heyday of speculation and the shadow economy now. It's high time to tell the people the truth. If urgent measures aren't taken, in the very near future, hunger and a new round of impoverishment will be inevitable, from which one step will be taken to mass manifestations of spontaneous discontent with devastating consequences. Only irresponsible people can rely on some help from abroad. Now, of course, he predicted the truth. Mass impoverishment was coming. It was going to crash, and they are getting money from abroad. He continues, for many years on all sides, we spell a commitment, the interest of the person, taking care of rights and social protection. A man turned out to be humiliated, impaired in real rights and opportunities, driven to despair before our eyes. All democratic institutions created by popular expression lose their weight and authority. This is a result of deliberate actions of those who, roughly violating the basic law of the USSR, commit an unconstitutional coup and are drawn to unbridled personal dictatorship. There's an attack on the rights of workers. The rights to work, education, healthcare, housing, recreation are called into question. Even basic personal security is more and more threatened. Crime is growing rapidly, organized and politicized. The country is plunging into the abyss of violence and lawlessness. Never before in the history of this country have the propaganda of sex and violence that endangered the life and health of future generations received such proportion. Millions of people demand action against the octopus of crime and blatant immorality. Clearly now, this is a conservative counter-revolution. This isn't Trotsky talking here. He's talking about crime gangs that are both organized and politicized. As this is the origin of the Jewish, all the books of the Jewish mafia, this is how they were formed. It was a so-called shadow economy. And these were the people connected with Jews in America, were promoting the complete disintegration, not of the Soviet Union, but of any moral code whatsoever. Then he continues. The pride and honor of Soviet man must be restored in full. The State Committee for the State of Emergency in the USSR, that's actually the full name of the thing, is fully aware of the depths of the crisis that hit the country. It assumes responsibility for the fate of the motherland and is determined to take the most serious measures to bring the state and society out of the crisis as soon as possible. We promise to hold a broad popular discussion of the draft new union treaty. Everyone will have the right and opportunity to comprehend this most important act in a common environment. The fate of many people in our great motherland will depend on what this union will be like. We will restore law and order, put an end to bloodshed, declare a merciless war on the criminal world, eradicate the shameful phenomenon that credit our society and humiliate Soviet citizens. We will cleanse the streets of our cities from criminal elements, put an end to the arbitrariness of the robbers of the people's good. We stand for actual, true democratic processes, for a consistent policy of reforms leading to the renewal of the motherland, to its economic and social prosperity. The development of a country should not be based on the decline in living standards. It will become the norm to continuously improve the well-being of citizens without weakening the concern for strengthening protection, the concern for strengthening individual rights. We will focus on protecting the interests of the broadest sections of the population who are the most affected by inflation, the disruption of production, corruption, and crime. Developing the multi-structure nature of the national economy, we will support private enterprise, providing it with necessary opportunities for development of production and services. Our primary concern will be food and housing. All available forces will be mobilized to meet these urgent needs of the people. We call upon workers, peasants, labor, intelligentsia, the orthodox, monarchists, nationalists, all Soviet people to restore labor discipline and order as soon as possible to raise the level of production so that they can decisively move forward. Our life and the future of our children and grandchildren, the fate of the fatherland, depend on this. That was read when the coup took over. That's an abbreviated. The whole thing is a bit longer. I couldn't read the whole thing. But that's what they stated. Now, they spoke for the majority of people in Russia and the places that remain loyal to the Union. It's pretty clear that we're not talking about, again, the Union of Joseph Stalin. They do want to see private enterprise. They are calling upon monarchists, nationalists, all anti-liberal forces to take over. In other parts of that speech, he explicitly calls on orthodox people and royalist people. This is not a, Marxist, revolution in the sense that, that you see on an American university campus. They would take these people and throw them in prison, if anything. And they mentioned, of course, usury. Gennady Yanyev, who writes, of course, that, you know, he also spoke to the population at this time. And, he says, let us unite so as to stop the chain reaction of the disastrous collapse of the state, economy, the human personality, in order to contribute the strengthening of the Soviet power, to transform it into a genuinely people's power and not some manager for the hungry nouveau riche who are ready to sell off everything for the sake of their insatiable appetite. Remember, the oligarchs who were in the process of taking over with American help liquidated and sold off 80% of the Russian economy for their own gratification. This is worse than anything that occurred before in the Soviet Union. The number of people lost through depopulation is over 30 million that would have been born had this not occurred. The collapse in the 90s caused a massive drop in the birth rate as well as the health and well-being of everyone. And the birth rate collapsed and Jews fled the Soviet Union in huge numbers. Right now, they're, I think, maybe 0.5% of the population, if that. This is absolutely essential to understand. It's, you know, the Soviet Union was not a great country. But they did have the rudiments to transform it into really what amounts to a national Bolshevik, Eurasianist, ultimately, it would be a right-wing counter-revolutionary movement. They mention usury all the time. They mention Western banks all the time. Khrushchev, who was the head of the KGB, he makes reference to this. He says it's essentially a Latin American mafia character, these reforms. In other words, this is about a tiny oligarchy who controls everything. And he says in the first 500 days, when, you know, Yeltsin takes over and imposes this on the country, the economy collapsed to the point where in 1997, they defaulted on all debts. The ruble was worthless. And as I said before, by 2000, when Putin took over, 80% of the economy had been completely liquidated. Really, all economic activity occurred in the black market. He says, the government shows its inability to ensure basic human rights, life, protection from criminal attacks. They go over and over again that these are Jewish cults that are forming the black market, that are taking over entire regions because salaries of police aren't being paid. Kids aren't showing up for the draft. Military, as you see here, the very fact that the military wasn't really supporting this thing, the military chain of command had collapsed. And no one knew what law to follow. Would it be the laws of the Soviet Union that Gorbachev ostensibly would administer, or Yeltsin? Or, of course, you lived elsewhere, your country, if it has declared independence. And on every country that declared independence, there was always a very strong pro-Soviet, especially in Georgia, because Georgia did very well in the Soviet Union, as did Armenia. These were very, very strong pro-Union movements. And they actually called on the Russian state to intervene, and they did so, but only very poorly. But in March of 91, they did vote for the restoration, not of the Soviet Union or Stalin, but of a strong union. And that should have pretty much been a bullet in the story that, you know, destroyed the entire liberal idea. The irony here is that while the Western press condemned these guys for creating a coup, Boris Yeltsin was to do the exact same thing right afterwards, taking massive amounts of power to himself with not only with American assistance, but it was the CIA's idea. You hear Putin being condemned every day for taking way too much power in the presidency, canceling the elections of the regions, you know, appointing governors with the majority of the local legislature, etc. All of these ideas are nothing compared to what the West demanded Yeltsin do. Because where the oligarchy is concerned, there was no law. Yeltsin was encouraged to essentially establish a personal dictatorship for the sake of imposing liberalism, and that's exactly what he did. One of the reasons that the emergency committee took over was that there were rumors around Poshka that year that the liberals were going to take over in a coup. There was going to be a liberal emergency committee. There was an attempt to bomb the American embassy in Moscow, a bomb near the FSB building, you know, rampant political extremism, all this kind of thing, and that Yeltsin's going to take over to solve all of these problems. Remember, this was right after the American attack on Yugoslavia. What was happening, what Yeltsin was doing when he became president of Russia, is cleansed law enforcement, all security agencies, from what he called unreliable persons. Anybody who acted against the oligarchy, replacing Pavel Maslov, for example, who was the commander of the internal troops of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, was just the beginning. He was removing prosecutors. None of this had any legal foundation. But with CIA support, with American money and American protection, he was making deals with Jewish mafia clans, and essentially the state became almost indistinguishable from them. Mass purges of the mid-level managers in the Ministry of Internal Affairs and the FSB. People talk about, you know, the FSB being the successor to the KGB, and I laugh. Yeltsin had gutted that organization. Almost nobody remained from the earlier years. It was a completely remade organization. So referring to it as a KGB shows ignorance. No, Yeltsin completely gutted it and remade it. The coup was actually scheduled for April 8th. And Primakov, of course, was going to visit Kiev. And it was going to be to get rid of him ultimately. And it was postponed. And because essentially Yeltsin was doing this pretty much anyway. Yeltsin did engage in a coup immediately after this. The defeat of the emergency committee permitted Boris Yeltsin to impose liberalism by force and violence, as liberalism is always imposed by force and violence. So there was, I mean, the coup, I mean, an actual coup was planned with CIA money. Since Yeltsin was doing this anyway, it really didn't happen. And because of the emergency committee, Yeltsin was able to engage in this coup and have no one notice because of the chaos that this created. This has created the idea that Yeltsin was very, and he was, Yeltsin and Gorbachev were very much aware that this was going to happen. And it's given rise to the notion that they almost planned this themselves to give them the cover to do what they did. Now, Gorbachev was not benefited by this, so he couldn't have been involved. Yeltsin most certainly was. This was comically poorly organized. Just the very picture alone. I remember seeing this on TV, and you could see it on the picture that we provide on the here. The background is gray. They're wearing gray suits, and these are men who just, you know, non-charismatic bureaucrats who had no idea how to speak to the population. Now, Gorbachev knew about this, and he did not reject the idea. This is something that Americans did not know at the time. If you remember, Mikhail Gorbachev was almost a deity in America. Finally, a communist we can justify, because communism was always the American obsession to promote it wherever possible, but not in its Stalinist guise. But before all this happened, Gorbachev knew the country is heading to the abyss. Gorbachev said, "We will not allow the Soviet Union to collapse. We will take all measures up to the imposition of a state of emergency." And with that, he flew to the Crimea for vacation. And when a group of supporters arrived on the 18th of August, Gorbachev said, that it's necessary to do this, but please don't include me in it. And he wanted to solve what he called the Yeltsin problem. And this is Yaniev's own, words here. But it became very clear, and Russians knew this at the time but without evidence. Now we know it with evidence. That's the CIA director, Robert Geitz, who was published in Izvestia in right after this in December of 1991. He said, "We understood that the Soviet Union could not be taken up either by economic pressure or by an arms race, or even less by force. They could only be destroyed by an explosion from the inside." And the question had nothing to do with prison camps, which were gone, had nothing to do with freedom of religion, which had been restored. That wasn't the issue. It was the fact that you had a massive Soviet market that Americans were less and less invested in. Again, the Jews had fled the country. The Jews were no longer involved in the Russian economy except in the black economy. And breaking the Soviet Union was necessary to get what is really a giant, very well-educated market. So what Americans didn't realize is that Gorbachev was aware of this. Gorbachev supported it. But he couldn't be a part of it because he wasn't sure it was going to work. He was pretty sure that the group of people who I listed in the beginning here, several of whom were murdered afterwards, they were amnestied a few years after that. They were arrested and tried and were eventually amnestied. Didn't have any kind of charisma. They were poor speakers. They were bureaucrats. You know, well, at least, you know, we make fun of politicians, but at least politicians have to speak to the public. These guys never had to do this before. They were bureaucrats, some of them talented bureaucrats, but most of them, you know, mediocres. And they had no idea how to communicate these ideas. And it reminds me of the White Army in the Russian Civil War, where the White Army never really communicated with the population, never really put out a manifesto, and never really even spoke of the fact that perestroika is really a Western creation. That Western capital is involved in creating the new oligarchy. The West had reoriented itself from Gorbachev to Yeltsin, and that it came time now that for an open connection of democracy and oligarchy. And even today, Western writers refer to Russian democracy as identical with oligarchy and, in fact, Jewish oligarchy. There were two visions. There was the liberal vision, which would have destroyed not only the Soviet Union, but Russia too, which was promoted by the West. And there was the National Socialist or even the National Bolshevik vision, which to some extent you could find in the Emergency Committee. The notion of declaring a state of emergency was brought up in circles of the Soviet government that entire year, and even as early as 1990. Gorbachev, though, really not being sure of these men having any ability to run anything, that these guys had any ability to shed blood, that these guys were in any position to shoot people. And if that would have, you know, just destroyed their whole movement anyway. Showing you, by the way, that these were decent guys. They could have just shot people up. It would have saved many lives because of the starvation that soon was to engulf the country. But just like in Tiananmen Square, if you look at the group of hippies that show up at the White House at the time, this is what, you know, American conservatives and right-wingers at the time was promoting as the anti-communist movement. And yet nationalists and monarchists and Orthodox people were, in fact, supporting the Emergency Committee. I'm not so sure that there was really ever a legitimate enmity between Yeltsin and Gorbachev. I have the feeling that this was mostly stage-managed. But things were going on at this time. Not only the threat of a liberal coup, which occurred anyway, just under different circumstances, but things were happening strangely that this coup was designed to stop. For example, the ultra modern, the Oka Operation Tactical Missile, which was just released at the time, was destroyed right after this. It lost, you know, they lost billions of rubles on this. The Oka had a 400 kilometer range. The oil shelf in the Bering Sea was handed over to the Americans. That deprived the Russian Navy of any sovereignty in that area. It completely altered the army in the Eastern Military District. The oil reserves on the shelf, the Bering Strait, are about the size of Kuwait. But the number of, and that was given over to Western corporations. This is very suspicious. The reduction of conventional weapons. The Soviets had far more ground troops than the USA, and even today has about five times the number of tanks. I mean, their border is much longer. They have every reason to have more men. But Gorbachev signed and was a part of a massive reduction of forces, especially a massive reduction in the Navy. In the by the late 70s, the Soviet fleet was the largest in the world. But the Soviet aircraft carriers were put out of commission, and many destroyers and battleships were put out of commission entirely. Another example is the withdrawal of troops from Eastern Europe and Mongolia. And this permitted liberal governments to take over. And I've talked about that on this show for many, many years. And it permitted the liberal states to simply buy their way into power. And in the newspapers after, one of my favorites that I've been reading for many years, Tatiana Vojvodina, she writes this on the topic, kind of summarizing what the ideology, the mentality of the coup was. And she says, and this is just, I'm translating this as I read it. If we do not recognize this fact, that the people did not support socialism, the Soviet Union, Soviet power and Soviet life, we will hang all the dogs, from the Anglo-Saxons, the Rothschilds, the Washington Regional Committee, the Fifth Column, Jews and others like them, who will be in a fog of self-deception. While in this fog, we will not be able to extract teaching from what happened. After all, failure and defeat are vulnerable, are valuable, and that you could learn from them a lesson that makes you stronger and smarter. Now, the concept is that people did reject the era of Khrushchev and Brezhnev, or even Andropov for that matter. A new union based on similar economic structures was really the only way to keep out the Rothschilds and the Fifth Column, the Jews, and what was being spoken of by the coup plotters at the time. Yuri Voronin says that, and I remember reading about this, remember American conservatives of all types were talking about this as this great victory. But capitalism was making war on the Soviet Union, not by attacking central planning or anything like that, but by showing how the wealthy live in Beverly Hills, by bribing, you know, state officials. You know, feminism was introduced to the women, extreme sexual liberation, all kinds of birth control provided by the Rockefellers and Planned Parenthood, the destruction of the family. This is what democracy was. And it had to do with the so-called liberation of the ego from all constraints. And this is something very, very good that the coup plotters mention over and over again. And this is what was being reacted to. Now, the fact that they dressed in gray and had this gray background for their big introductory speech shows their ignorance. They're fighting the glitz and the glamour of this new Western media that's showing them rich Americans and the one, you know, connecting that with multiculturalism and feminism and everything else, you know, pornography pouring into the place. And of course, local Jews being a central conduit in bringing that there, and the black market mafia being extremely important in that. This is what democracy was. This is how you capture people and turn them into good Americans. And of course, they were right. But this is what this coup was against. Now, the All Russian Center for the Study of Public Opinion, they conduct every year, actually, a study about how they view these events of August of 1991. Now, in 1994, about 38% of the Russian population said that suppressing this was a tragic event. But in 1999, only 9% of Russians said that the suppression of the emergency committee was a victory of the democratic revolution. In fact, 40% says that this is nothing more than a struggle for power of the country's top leadership. You start having, over the last 15 years, a pretty big increase in those saying that that the suppression of the emergency committee was destructive. Karamirza, one of my favorite writers in his history of the state and rights of Russia, from Publishing House by Lenin in 1998. The history of the Soviet state and law. He talks about Yeltsin's election president of Russia, but 43%, and immediately demands extraordinary powers. That if any other government did this, the West would condemn them vehemently, but it turns out that he's winning with American money. The arrogance of the American ruling class talking about Russian interference in American elections, and this isn't interference. The Americans created these elections. They provided the ballot boxes. They did everything, including the media. It was an American election. So he goes even beyond this interference. They created it. But what everyone was shocked at was the legitimacy of the coup, the very good ideas that they had, that they were very poorly put out, the miserable failure. There were no political organizations that were mobilized. It was just a handful of guys who headed important ministries, and that was it. Yeah, the head of the KGB was one of the coup plotters. That doesn't mean the KGB did anything. That was simply using his office in this respect. No organized political forces were ever involved in their rally. They didn't bring any people into the square in front of the White House to protest. The Politburo did nothing during this period of time. No one in the party actually realized that this push was going to happen. There was no meeting. There was no work. And again, it gives some credence to the notion that Yeltsin created this. Now, I don't think that's true. It just goes to show how bad it was and how incompetent it was. There was nothing. Like, for example, there was a Soyuz group, which is a faction in the legislature and in the party, who very early on demanded that Yeltsin be removed and a state of emergency be imposed, had nothing to do with this coup. They never brought them in. And so you had movements all over the place that had popular followings, that had money, that had great influence, even media contacts, which weren't even spoken to before this coup happened. Riot police show up to disperse these liberal demonstrators and immediately put their shields down. There was no mass demonstrations in favor of this coup whatsoever. Nobody went on strike. There was no, even though no one had any faith in Gorbachev's reforms anymore, already the impoverishment of the country was clear, the ruble was becoming worthless. But the first thing that Yeltsin does when he takes over is to ban the CPSU, not to mention the Communist Party of the Russian Federation as well. Now remember, in banning the Communist Party and its related organizations, they banned, at least temporarily, the Eurasianist movement, the National Bolshevik movement. Yeltsin imposed an extremely violent, authoritarian liberal organization because this was a brand new government now, the so-called independent Russian Federation, and Yeltsin, with American money and at American insistence, created more or less a liberal Judaic dictatorship. But there were so many people that were left out of this coup that it couldn't have been. It couldn't have been anything but a creation of the liberals. It was a gift to them. Nobody, I mean, even the soldiers who showed up their guns weren't loaded. This is completely, it was an unconditional triumph for Yeltsin. And the fact that state TV had his triumphal speech on top of a tank who had defected to his side shows that no one knew what was going on. Absolutely no one knew what was going on. Now, I don't think Yeltsin created this, but he knew about it. We know that George Bush had contacted Gorbachev sometime before, and as well as Yeltsin, and said this was coming. So it was just a matter of how to respond to it. So, you know, it was a destruction of any, not just communist in the traditional Leninist sense, but any anti-liberal force was destroyed in the '90s from August of 1991. The mayor of Moscow in June of 91 went to the U.S. embassy and, he was told by the CIA that a coup is coming and that you have to prepare for your reaction to it. The American embassy at the time wasn't sure who was going to be doing it. The mayor at the time, Popov, who said, it would be Prime Minister Pavlov, Khrushchev, and Yazov. And so he was right on two people. And so there were factions of the CIA who were very much involved with this, so that the embassy wasn't entirely certain. So this was definitely happening. And they made a big deal about it, despite the fact that they were planning a liberal coup, whether or not. The 1991 events were a way that Yeltsin was able to take over and establish a dictatorship without having to worry about it. Without this, it would have been more of a problem. And unfortunately, it was a gift. It was a gift to the left. To liberals. The notion of an emergency committee had been bounced around since 89. Some of the leaders of the coup, quote unquote, committed suicide afterwards. Boris Pugo, you know, I'd always believed had killed himself, and yet apparently he shot his wife and then himself, but there were three shell casings on the floor. And his gun was put neatly on the nightstand next to him. And he was wearing a tracksuit, of all things. But immediately after the putsch, Yeltsin's coup, counter coup, these suicides began. Key people in the management of the country began falling out of windows, jumping off balconies, hanging themselves, in huge numbers. Gorbachev's military advisor, Akhromyev, in August 24th, hanged himself, which is, you know, highly unlikely. He would have taken a gun. I mean, some of his people, when he was found hanged, said, "Wait a minute, he would have just shot himself." He was found in a sitting position. So it didn't make any sense. It's pretty much, you know, these people were murdered. The manager of the Central Committee, Kuchina, jumped off the balcony of his apartment on August 26th. And by the way, he was one of the liaisons from the party's economic activities, including the allocation of funds from Western banks. And his predecessor jumped out of a window, October 6th. Grigory Pavlov, another Central Committee guy, CPSU, jumped off his balcony, his apartment, the 12th floor on, Dmitry, Lesovic also threw himself off the balcony. It's really strange that in the month or so after the coup, so many of these guys and supporters of the emergency committee, it's like they were raining down on Moscow. And of course, had they arrested Yeltsin, which they could have easily done, they may have fully received Gorbachev's support. Alexander Dugin fully supported the emergency committee. He saw it as really the synthesis of the anti-liberal movement. But also, of course, you know, made fun of their awful, organization. He does believe, though, that the liberals needed people like Lukyanov removed at all costs, and that this was a provocation that liberals created, although weren't quite sure in what direction it was going to go. They were actually surprised about how bad it was done. There was a panic amongst liberals at the time, and but because this was so poorly organized, the failure was guaranteed. But not only that, Yeltsin then was able to destroy the country with, you know, people like Gaidar and everyone else. Primakov was on his way out. The coup gave Yeltsin and the CIA in the West the green light to destroy Russia. And it was well-intentioned. It was spontaneous, which is easy to prove because no one knew what was going to happen. And will go down in history as the worst, the most awfully organized coup d'etat in political history. And I can't help but compare it with the White Army. As I mentioned, this inability to talk to people, this inability to propagandize, this inability to do anything but give speeches in front of a gray curtain, wearing a gray suit in monotone. And yet Boris Yeltsin standing on top of a tank with people playing guitars around him and, you know, fornication going on and homo flags going. That was different. That at least, you know, appealed to a certain faction. That kind of liberalism and the nouveau riche that it created created a faction that then was going to force this stuff through with American help. Yes, they can't get more than 5% in elections today, but at the time, it was the only group that actually was appealing to anybody. The coup lost because they simply didn't know what they were doing, because they didn't bring anyone involved. It was so spontaneous and poorly organized, and it was the best thing that happened to Yeltsin. And as a result, the peoples of the former Soviet Union lost about 30 million people, whether it be from bad health, abortion, starvation, or the complete decline, collapse of the birth rate, which Putin has finally reversed. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.